This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents City of Thieves by David Benioff. Read by Ron Perlman. For Amanda and Frankie. And if the city falls, but a single man escapes, he will carry the city within himself on the roads of exile. He will be the city. Zbigniew Herbert. At last, Shank thought he understood and began laughing louder. Then suddenly he asked in a serious tone, "Do you think that the Russians are homosexuals?" "You'll find out at the end of the war," I replied. Curzio Malaparte. My grandfather, the knife fighter, killed 2 Germans before he was 18. I don't remember anyone telling me. It was something I always seemed to know, the way I knew the Yankees wore pinstripes for home games and gray for the road. But I wasn't born with the knowledge. Who told me? Not my father, who never shared secrets, or my mother, who shied away from mentioning the unpleasant, all things bloody, cancerous, or deformed. Not my grandmother, who knew every folktale from the old country, most of them gruesome, children devoured by wolves and beheaded by witches, but never spoke about the war in my hearing. And certainly not my grandfather himself, the smiling watchman of my earliest memories, the quiet black-eyed slender man who held my hand as we crossed the avenues, who sat on the park bench reading his Russian newspaper while I chased pigeons and harassed sugar ants with broken twigs. I grew up 2 blocks from my grandparents and saw them nearly every day. They had their own small insurance company, working out of their railroad apartment in Bay Ridge, catering primarily to other Russian immigrants. My grandmother was always on the phone, selling. No one could resist her. She charmed them, or she frightened them, and either way, they bought. My grandfather manned the desk, doing all the paperwork. When I was small, I would sit on his lap, staring at the stump of his left index finger, rounded and smooth, the top 2 knuckles so cleanly severed it seemed he'd been born without them. If it was summer and the Yankees were playing, a radio, after his 70th birthday, a color television my dad bought him, broadcast the game. He never lost his accent, he never voted in an election or listened to American music, but he became a devout Yankees fan. In the late 90s, an insurance conglomerate made an offer for my grandparents' company. It was, according to everyone, a fair offer, so my grandmother asked them to double it. There must have been a good deal of haggling, but I could have told the conglomerate that haggling with my grandmother was a waste of time. In the end, they gave her what she wanted, and my grandparents, following tradition, sold their apartment and moved to Florida. They bought a small house on the Gulf Coast, a flat-roofed masterpiece built in 1949 by an architect who would have become famous if he hadn't drowned the same year. Stark and majestic in steel and poured concrete, sitting on a solitary bluff overlooking the Gulf, it is not the house you'd imagine for a retired couple, but they didn't move south to wither in the sun and die. Most days, my grandfather sits at his computer, playing chess online with old friends. My grandmother, bored by inactivity within weeks of the move, created a job for herself at a commuter college in Sarasota, teaching Russian literature to tan students who seem, based on my one classroom visit, constantly alarmed by her profanity, her heavy sarcasm, and her word-perfect memory of Pushkin's verse. Every night, my grandparents eat dinner on the deck of their house, looking out over the dark waters toward Mexico. They sleep with the windows open, the moths battering their wings against the mesh screens. Unlike the other retirees I've met in Florida, they are not worried about crime. The front door is usually unlocked, and there is no alarm system. They don't wear their seat belts in the car. They don't wear suntan lotion in the sun. They have decided nothing can kill them but God himself, and they don't even believe in him. I live in Los Angeles and write screenplays about mutant superheroes. 2 years ago, I was asked to write an autobiographical essay for a screenwriting magazine, and midway through, I realized I had led an intensely dull life. Not that I'm complaining. Even if the summary of my existence makes boring reading, school, college, odd jobs, graduate school, odd jobs, more graduate school, mutant superheroes, I've had a good time existing. But as I struggled through the essay, I decided I didn't want to write about my life, not even for 500 words. I wanted to write about Leningrad. My grandparents picked me up at the Sarasota airport. I stooped to kiss them, and they smiled up at me, always slightly bemused in the presence of their giant American grandson. At 6'2", I'm a giant next to them. On the way home, we bought pompano at the local fish market. My grandfather grilled it, adding nothing but butter, salt, and fresh lemon. Like every dish he made, it seemed incredibly easy to do, took him 10 minutes, and tasted better than anything I'd eaten that year in L.A. My grandmother doesn't cook. She is famous in our family for her refusal to prepare anything more complicated than a bowl of cereal. After dinner, my grandmother lit a cigarette, and my grandfather poured 3 glasses of homemade blackcurrant vodka. We listened to a choir of cicadas and crickets, stared out at the black gulf, and slapped away the occasional mosquito. I brought a tape recorder with me. I thought maybe we could talk about the war. I thought I caught my grandmother rolling her eyes as she flicked her ash onto the grass. What? You're 40 years old. Now you want to know? I'm 34. I looked at my grandfather, and he smiled at me. What's the matter? You guys were Nazis? You're hiding your Nazi past? No, he said, still smiling. We weren't Nazis. You thought I was 40 years old? 34, 40. She made her psh sound, always accompanied by a dismissive wave of the hand, slapping away the stupidity. Who cares? Get married, find a wife. You sound like every other grandmother in Florida. Ha! She said, a little wounded. I want to know what it was like. What's so horrible about that? She nodded at my grandfather while pointing the burning tip of her cigarette at me. He wants to know what it was like. Darling, said my grandfather. Just that, nothing else. But my grandmother nodded and stubbed out her cigarette on the glass top table. You're right, she told me. You want to write about the war? You should. She stood, kissed me on the top of my head, kissed my grandfather on the lips, and carried the dishes inside the house. For a few minutes we sat there quietly, listening to the waves breaking. He poured us fresh vodkas, happy to see I'd finished mine. You have a girlfriend? Uh-huh. The actress? Yeah. You like her? I know you do. She could be Russian, he said. She has the eyes. If you want to talk about Leningrad, we talk about Leningrad. I don't want to talk. I want you to talk. So, okay, I'll talk. Tomorrow? He kept his word. For the next week, we sat together every day on the concrete deck, and I recorded his stories. A few hours in the morning, breaking for lunch, then again in the afternoon, my grandfather, a man who hated to speak more than 2 consecutive sentences in mixed company, meaning in the company of anyone other than his wife, filled mini-cassette after mini-cassette with his words. Too many words for one book. Truth might be stranger than fiction, but it needs a better editor. For the first time in my life, I heard my grandfather curse and speak openly about sex. He talked about his childhood, about the war, about coming to America, but mostly, he talked about 1 week in 1942, the first week of the year, the week he met my grandmother, made his best friend, and killed 2 Germans. When he was finished telling his stories, I questioned him about various details, names, locations, weather conditions on certain days. He tolerated this for a while, but eventually he leaned forward and pressed the stop button on the tape recorder. It was a long time ago, he said. I don't remember what I was wearing. I don't remember if the sun came out. I just want to make sure I get everything right. You won't. This is your story. I don't want to fuck with it. David, a couple of things still don't make sense to me. David, he said, you're a writer. Make it up. Chapter 1. You have never been so hungry. You have never been so cold. When we slept, if we slept, we dreamed of the feasts we had carelessly eaten 7 months earlier. All that buttered bread, the potato dumplings, the sausages, eaten with disregard, swallowing without tasting, leaving great crumbs on our plates, scraps of fat. In June of 1941, before the Germans came, we thought we were poor, but June seemed like paradise by winter. At night the wind blew so loud and long it startled you when it stopped. The shutter hinges of the burned-out cafe on the corner would quit creaking for a few ominous seconds, as if a predator neared, and the smaller animals hushed in terror. The shutters themselves had been torn down for firewood in November. There was no more scrap wood in Leningrad. Every wood sign, the slats of the park benches, the floorboards of shattered buildings, all gone and burning in someone's stove. The pigeons were missing, too, caught and stewed in melted ice from the Neva. No one minded slaughtering pigeons. It was the dogs and cats that caused trouble. You would hear a rumor in October that someone had roasted the family mutt and split it four ways for supper. We'd laugh and shake our heads, not believing it, and also wondering if dog tasted good with enough salt. There was still plenty of salt. Even when everything else ran out, we had salt. By January, the rumors had become plain fact. No one but the best connected could still feed a pet, so the pets fed us. There were two theories on the fat versus the thin. Some said those who were fat before the war stood a better chance of survival. A week without food would not transform a plump man into a skeleton. Others said skinny people were more accustomed to eating little and could better handle the shock of starvation. I stood in the latter camp, purely out of self-interest. I was a runt from birth, big-nosed, black-haired, skin scribbled with acne. Let's admit, I was no girl's idea of a catch. But war made me more attractive. Others dwindled as the ration cards were cut and cut again, halving those who looked like circus strongmen before the invasion. I had no muscle to lose. Like the shrews that kept scavenging while the dinosaurs toppled around them, I was built for deprivation. On New Year's Eve, I sat on the rooftop of the Kirov, the apartment building where I'd lived since I was five, though it had no name until 34 when Kirov was shot and half the city was named after him, watching the fat gray anti-aircraft blimps swarm under the clouds, waiting for the bombers. That time of year, the sun lingers in the sky for only 6 hours, scurrying from horizon to horizon, as if spooked. Every night, four of us would sit on the roof for a 3-hour shift, armed with sand pails, iron tongs, and shovels, bundled in all the shirts and sweaters and coats we could find, watching the skies. We were the firefighters. The Germans had decided rushing the city would be too costly, so instead they encircled us, intending to starve us out, bomb us out, burn us out. Before the war began, 1,100 people lived in the Kirov. By New Year's Eve, the number was closer to 400. Most of the small children were evacuated before the Germans closed the circle in September. My mother and little sister Taisa went to Vyazma and stayed with my uncle. The night before they left, I fought with my mother, the only fight we'd ever had, or more precisely, the only time I ever fought back. She wanted me to go with them, of course, far away from the invaders, deep into the heart of the country where the bombers couldn't find us. But I wasn't leaving Peter. I was a man. I would defend my city. I would be a Nevsky for the 20th century. Perhaps I wasn't quite this ridiculous. I had a real argument. If every able-bodied soul fled, Leningrad would fall to the fascists. And without Leningrad, without the city of workers building tanks and rifles for the Red Army, what chance did Russia have? My mother thought this was a stupid argument. I was barely 17. I didn't weld armor at the works, and I couldn't enlist in the army for close to a year. The defense of Leningrad had nothing to do with me. I was just another mouth to feed. I ignored these insults. "I'm a firefighter," I told her, because it was true. The city council had ordered the creation of 10,000 firefighting units, and I was the proud commander of the Kirov 5th Floor Brigade. My mother wasn't 40 years old, but her hair was already gray. She sat across from me at the kitchen table, holding one of my hands in both of hers. She was a very small woman, barely 5 feet tall, and I had been afraid of her from birth. "You're an idiot," she told me. Maybe this sounds insulting, but my mother always called me her idiot, and by that point I had thought of it as an affectionate nickname. "The city was here before you. It will be here after you. Taisia and I need you." She was right. A better son would have gone with her. A better brother. Taisia adored me, jumped on me when I came home from school, read me the silly little poem she wrote as homework to honor martyrs of the revolution, drew caricatures of my big-nosed profile in her notebook. Generally, I wanted to strangle her. I had no desire to tramp across the country with my mother and kid sister. I was 17, flooded with a belief of my own heroic destiny. Molotov's declaration during his radio address on the first day of the war, "Our cause is just. The enemy will be beaten. We shall triumph," had been printed on thousands of posters and pasted on the city's walls. I believed in the cause. I would not flee the enemy. I would not miss out on the triumph. Mother and Taisia left the next morning. They rode a bus part of the way, flagged down army trucks for rides, and walked endless miles on country roads in their split-soled boots. It took them 3 weeks to get there, but they made it, safe at last. She sent me a letter describing her journey, the terror and fatigue. Maybe she wanted me to feel guilty for abandoning them, and I did. But I also knew it was better with them gone. The great fight was coming, and they did not belong on the front. On the 7th of October, the Germans took Vyazma, and her letters stopped coming. I'd like to say I missed them when they were gone, and some nights I was lonely, and I always missed my mother's cooking. But I had fantasized about being on my own since I was little. My favorite folk tales featured resourceful orphans who make their way through the dark forest, surviving all perils with clever problem-solving, outwitting their enemies, finding their fortune in the midst of their wanderings. I wouldn't say I was happy. We were all too hungry to be happy. But I believe that here, at last, was the meaning. If Leningrad fell, Russia would fall. If Russia fell, fascism would conquer the world. All of us believed this. I still believe it. So I was too young for the army, but old enough to dig anti-tank ditches by day and guard the roofs by night. Manning my crew were my friends from the fifth floor, Vera Osipovna, a talented cellist, and the red-headed Antokolsky twins, whose only known talent was an ability to fart in harmony. In the early days of the war, we had smoked cigarettes on the roof, posing as soldiers, brave and strong and square-chinned, scanning the skies for the enemy. But by the end of December, there were no cigarettes in Leningrad, at least none made with tobacco. A few desperate souls crushed fallen leaves, rolled them in paper, and called them autumn lights, claiming the right leaves provided a decent smoke. But in the Kirov, far from the nearest standing tree, this was never an option. We spent our spare minutes hunting rats, who must have thought the disappearance of the city's cats was the answer to all their ancient prayers, until they realized there was nothing left to eat in the garbage. After months of bombing raids, we could identify the various German planes by the pitch of their engines. That night it was the Junkers 88s, as it had been for weeks, replacing the Heinkels and the Dorniers that our fighters had gotten good at gunning down. As wretched as our city had become in daylight, after dark there was a strange beauty in the siege. From the roof of the Kirov, if the moon was out, we could see all of Leningrad, the needle point of the Admiralty Tower, splashed with gray paint to obscure it from the bombers, the Peter and Paul Fortress, spires draped with camouflage netting, the domes of St. Isaac's, and the church on spilled blood. We could see the crews manning the anti-aircraft guns on the rooftops of neighboring buildings. The Baltic fleet had dropped anchor on the Neva. They floated there, giant gray sentries, firing their big guns at the Nazi artillery emplacements. Most beautiful were the dogfights. The Ju-88s and the Sukhois circled above the city, invisible from below unless they were caught in the eyes of the powerful searchlights. The Sukhois had large red stars painted on the undersides of their wings, so our anti-aircraft crews wouldn't shoot them down. Every few nights we'd see a battle spotlit, as if for the stage, the heavier, slower German bombers banking hard to let their gunners get a bead on the darting Russian fighters. When a Junkers went down, the plane's burning carcass falling like an angel cast from heaven, a great shout of defiance rose up from the rooftops all across the city, all the gunners and firefighters shaking their fists to salute the victorious pilot. We had a little radio on the roof with us. On New Year's Eve, we listened to the Spassky chimes in Moscow playing the Internazionale. Vera had found half an onion somewhere. She cut it into four pieces on a plate, smeared with sunflower oil. When the onion was gone, we mopped up the remaining oil with our ration bread. Ration bread did not taste like bread. It did not taste like food. After the Germans bombed the Badaev grain warehouses, the city bakeries got creative. Everything that could be added to the recipe without poisoning people was added to the recipe. The entire city was starving. No one had enough to eat, and still, everyone cursed the bread, the sawdust flavor, how hard it got in the cold. People broke their teeth trying to chew it. Even today, even when I've forgotten the faces of people I loved, I can still remember the taste of that bread. Half an onion and a 125-gram loaf of bread split four ways. This was a decent meal. We lay on our backs, wrapped in blankets, watching the air raid blimps on their long tethers drifting in the wind, listening to the radio's metronome. When there was no music to play or news to report, the radio station transmitted the sound of a metronome, that endless tick-tick-tick, letting us know the city was still unconquered, the fascists still outside the gate. The broadcast metronome was Peter's beating heart, and the Germans never stilled it. It was Vera who spotted the man falling from the sky. She shouted and pointed, and we all stood to get a better look. One of the searchlights shone on a parachutist descending toward the city, his silk canopy, a white tulip bulb, above him. "A Fritz," said Oleg Antokolsky, and he was right. We could see a gray Luftwaffe uniform. Where had he come from? None of us had heard the sounds of aerial combat or the report of an AA gun. We hadn't heard a bomber passing overhead for close to an hour. "Maybe it started," said Vera. For weeks we'd been hearing rumors that the Germans were preparing a massive paratrooper drop, a final raid to pluck the miserable thorn of Leningrad from their advancing army's backside. At any minute, we expected to look up and see thousands of Nazis drifting toward the city, a snowstorm of white parachutes blotting out the sky. But dozens of searchlights slashed through the darkness and found no more enemies. There was only this one, and judging from the limpness of the body suspended from the parachute harness, he was already dead. We watched him drift down, frozen in the searchlight, low enough that we could see that one of his black boots was missing. "He's coming our way," I said. The wind blew him toward Voinovo Street. The twins looked at each other. "Luger," said Oleg. "Luftwaffe don't carry Lugers," said Grisha. He was 5 minutes older and the authority on Nazi weaponry. "Walther, PPK." Vera smiled at me. "German chocolate." We ran for the stairway door, abandoning our firefighting tools, racing down the dark stairwell. We were fools, of course. A slip on one of those concrete steps with no fat or muscle to cushion the fall meant a broken bone, and a broken bone meant death. But none of us cared. We were very young, and a dead German was falling into Voinovo Street, carrying gifts from Das Vaterland. We sprinted through the courtyard and climbed over the locked gate. All the street lamps were dark. The entire city was dark, partly to make the job tougher for the bombers, and partly because most of the electricity was diverted to the munitions factories. But the moon was bright enough to see by. Voinovo was wide open and deserted, 6 hours into curfew, no cars in sight. Only the military and government had access to gasoline, and all the civilian autos had been requisitioned during the first months of the war. Strips of paper crossed the shop windows, which the radio told us made them more resistant to shattering. Maybe this was true. though I had walked by many storefronts in Leningrad where nothing remained in the window frame but a dangling strip of paper. Out on the street, we looked into the sky, but could not find our man.
Where did he go?
You think he landed on a roof? The searchlights were tracking the sky, but they were all mounted on top of tall buildings, and none of them had an angle to shine down Vonjova Street. Vera tugged on the collar of my greatcoat, a vast old navy coat inherited from my father and still too big for me, but warmer than anything else I owned. I turned and saw him gliding down the street, our German, his single black boots skidding over the frozen pavement, the great canopy of his white parachute still swollen in the wind, blowing him toward the gates of the Kirov, his chin slumped against his chest, his dark hair flecked with crystals of ice, his face bloodless in the moonlight. We stood very still and watched him sail closer. We had seen things that winter no eye should ever see. We thought we were beyond surprise, but we were wrong. And if the German had drawn his Walther and begun shooting, none of us would have been able to get our feet moving in time. But the dead man stayed dead, and at last the wind gave out, the parachute deflated, and he slumped to the pavement, dragging another few meters face down in final humiliation. We gathered around the pilot. He was a tall man, well built, and if we had seen him walking around Peter in street clothes, we would have known him at once for an infiltrator. He had the body of a man who ate meat every day. Grisha knelt and unholstered the German sidearm. Walther PPK. Told you. We rolled the German onto his back. His pale face was scuffed, the skin scraped on the asphalt, the abrasions as colorless as the intact skin. The dead don't bruise. I couldn't tell if he had died frightened or defiant or peaceful. There was no trace of life or personality in his face. He looked like a corpse who had been born a corpse. Oleg stripped off the black leather gloves while Vera went for the scarf and goggles. I found a sheath strapped to the pilot's ankle and pulled out a beautifully weighted knife with a silver finger guard and a 15-centimeter single-edged blade etched with words I could not read in the moonlight. I resheathed the blade and strapped it to my own ankle, feeling for the first time in months that my warrior destiny was at last coming true. Oleg found the dead man's wallet and grinned as he counted out the Deutschmarks. Vera pocketed a chronometer, twice as big as a wristwatch, that the German had worn around the sleeve of his flight jacket. Grisha found a pair of folded binoculars in a leather case, two extra magazines for the Walther, and a slim hip flask. He unscrewed the cap, sniffed, and passed me the flask.
Cognac?
I took a sip and nodded.
Cognac.
When did you ever taste cognac? Asked Vera.
I've had it before.
When? Let me see, said Oleg, and the bottle went around the circle, the four of us squatting on our haunches around the fallen pilot, sipping the liquor that might have been cognac or brandy or Armagnac. None of us knew the difference. Whatever it was, the stuff was warmth in the belly. Vera stared at the German's face. Her expression held no pity, no fear, only curiosity and contempt. The invader had come to drop his bombs on our city, and instead had dropped himself. We hadn't shot him down, but we felt triumphant anyway. No one else in the Kirov had come across an enemy's corpse. We would be the talk of the apartment block in the morning.
How do you think he died?
She asked. No bullet wounds blemished the body, no singed hair or leather, no sign of any violence at all. His skin was far too white for the living, but nothing had pierced it. He froze to death, I told them. I said it with authority because I knew it was true, and I had no way to prove it. The pilot had bailed out thousands of feet above nighttime Leningrad. The air at ground level was too cold for the clothes he was wearing. Up in the clouds, outside of his warm cockpit, he never had a chance. Grisha raised the flask in salute. Here's to the cold. The flask began to circle again. It never got to me. We should have heard the car's engine from two blocks away. The city, after curfew, was quiet as the moon. But we were busy drinking our German liquor, making our toasts. Only when the GAZ turned onto Vonjova Street, heavy tires rattling on the asphalt, headlights stabbing toward us, did we realize the danger. The punishment for violating curfew without a permit was summary execution. The punishment for abandoning a firefighting detail was summary execution. The punishment for looting was summary execution. The courts no longer operated. The police officers were on the front lines. The prisons half full and dwindling fast. Who had food for an enemy of the state? If you broke the law and you were caught, you were dead. There wasn't time for any legal niceties. So we ran. We knew the Kirov better than anyone. Once we got inside the courtyard gates and into the chilled darkness of the sprawling building, no one could find us if they had 3 months to search. We could hear the soldiers shouting at us to stop, but that didn't matter. Voices didn't frighten us. Only bullets made a difference, and no one had pulled a trigger yet. Grisha made it to the gate first. He was the closest thing to an athlete among us. He leaped onto the iron bars and hoisted himself upward. Oleg was right behind him, and I was behind Oleg. Our bodies were weak, muscles shrunken from lack of protein, but fear helped us scale the gate as quickly as we ever had. Near the top of the gate, I looked back and saw that Vera had slipped on a patch of ice. She stared up at me, her eyes round and fearful, on her hands and knees as the GAZ braked beside the body of the German pilot, and four soldiers stepped out. They were 20 feet away, their rifles in their hands, but I still had time to pull myself over the gate and disappear into the Kirov. I wish I could tell you that the thought of deserting Vera never entered my mind, that my friend was in danger, and I went to her rescue without hesitation. Truly, though, at that moment, I hated her. I hated her for being clumsy at the worst possible time, for staring up at me with her panicked brown eyes, electing me to be her savior, even though Grisha was the one and only one she had ever kissed. I knew that I could not live with the memory of those eyes pleading for me, and she knew it too, and I hated her even as I jumped down from the gate, lifted her to her feet, and hauled her to the iron doors. I was weak, but Vera couldn't have weighed 40 kilos. I boosted her onto the gate as the soldiers shouted, and their boot heels slapped on the pavement, and the bolts of their rifles snapped into place. Vera went over the top, and I scrambled up behind her, ignoring the soldiers. If I stopped, they would gather around me, tell me I was an enemy of the state, force me to kneel, and shoot me in the back of the head. I was an easy target now. But maybe they were drunk. Maybe they were city boys like me, who had never fired a shot before in their lives. Maybe they would miss on purpose, because they knew I was a patriot and defender of the city, and I had snuck out of the Kirov only because a German had fallen 20,000 feet onto my street. And what 17-year-old Russian boy would not sneak outside to peek at a dead fascist? My chin was level with the top of the gate when I felt the gloved hand wrap around my ankles. Strong hands, the hands of army men who ate 2 meals every day. I saw Vera run inside the Kirov, never looking back. I tried to cling to the iron bars, but the soldiers dragged me down, tossed me to the sidewalk, and stood above me, the muzzles of their Tokarovs jabbing at my cheeks. None of the soldiers looked older than 19, and none seemed reluctant to splatter the street with my brains.
"Looks ready to shit himself, this one. You having a party here, son? Found yourself some schnapps?"
"He's a good one for the colonel. He can ride with the Fritz." Two of them bent down, grabbed me under the armpits, yanked me to my feet, guided me to the still idling GAZ, and shoved me into the back seat. The other two soldiers lifted the German by his hands and boots and swung him into the car beside me.
"Keep him warm," one of them said, and they all laughed, as if it were the funniest joke ever told.
They squeezed into the car and slammed the doors. I decided I was still alive because they wanted to execute me in public, as a warning to other looters. A few minutes before, I had felt far more powerful than the dead pilot. Now, as we sped down the dark street, swerving to avoid bomb craters and sprays of rubble, he seemed to be smirking at me, his white lips a scar splitting his frozen face. We were going the same way. Chapter 2. If you grew up in Peter, you grew up fearing the crosses, that gloomy red brick stain on the Neva, a brutish, brooding warehouse of the lost. 6,000 convicts lived there in peacetime. I doubt 1,000 were left by January. Hundreds imprisoned for petty crimes were released into Red Army units, released into the meat grinder of the German Blitzkrieg. Hundreds more starved in their cells. Each day the guards dragged the skin-draped skeletons out of the crosses and onto sledges where the dead were stacked 8 high. When I was small, it was the silence of the prison that frightened me most. You walked by expecting to hear the shouts of rough men or the clamor of a brawl, but no noise escaped the thick walls, as if the prisoners inside, most of them awaiting trial or a trip to the gulag or a bullet in the head, hacked out their own tongues to protest their fate. The place was an anti-fortress designed to keep the enemies inside, and every boy in Leningrad had heard the phrase 100 times. You keep on with that, and you'll end up in the crosses. I had seen my cell only for a second when the guards shoved me inside, their lamps shining on the rough stone walls, a cell 2 meters wide and 4 meters long, with bunk beds for 4, and all of them empty. I was relieved at that. I didn't want to share the darkness with a stranger with tattooed knuckles. But after a time, minutes, hours, the black silence began to feel tangible, something that could get into your lungs and drown you. Darkness and solitude generally didn't frighten me. Electricity was as rare as bacon in Peter those days, and my apartment in the Kirov was empty now that Mother and Taisia had fled. The long nights were dark and quiet, but there was always noise somewhere. Mortars fired from the German lines, an army truck motoring down the boulevard, the dying old woman upstairs moaning in her bed. Awful sounds, really, but sounds. Something to let you know you were still in this world. That cell in the crosses was the only truly silent place I'd ever entered. I could hear nothing at all. I could see nothing. They had locked me in death's waiting room. As siege-hardened as I believed I was before my arrest, the truth was I had no more courage in January than I had in June. Contrary to popular belief, the experience of terror does not make you braver. Perhaps, though, it is easier to hide your fear when you're afraid all the time. I tried to think of a song to sing, a poem to recite, but all the words were stuck inside my head like salt in a caked shaker. I lay on one of the top bunks, hoping whatever heat existed within the crosses would rise and find me. Morning promised nothing but a bullet in the brain, and yet I longed for daylight to seep inside. When they dumped me in the cell, I thought I had seen a sliver of barred window near the ceiling, but now I couldn't remember. I tried counting to 1,000 to pass some time, but always got lost around 400. Hearing phantom rats that turned out to be my own fingers scratching the torn mattress. The night was never going to end. The Germans had shot down the fucking sun. They could do it. Why not? Their scientists were the best in the world. They could figure it out. They had learned how to stop time. I was blind and deaf. Only the cold and my thirst reminded me that I was alive. You get so lonely you start longing for the sentries, just to hear their footsteps, smell the vodka on their breath. So many great Russians endured long stretches in prison. That night I learned I would never be a great Russian. A few hours alone in a cell, suffering no torture other than the darkness and the silence and the absolute cold. A few hours of that, and I was already half broken. The fierce souls who survived winter after winter in Siberia possessed something I did not. Great faith in some splendid destiny. Whether God's kingdom, or justice, or the distant promise of revenge. Or maybe they were so beaten down they became nothing more than animals on their hind legs, working at their master's command, eating whatever slop he threw down for them, sleeping when ordered, and dreaming of nothing but the end. At last there was noise, footsteps, several sets of heavy boots clomping in the corridor. A key turned in the lock. I sat up in bed and cracked my skull against the ceiling hard enough that I bit through my lip. 2 guards, one of them holding an oil lamp, the prettiest light I ever saw, better than any sunrise, escorted a new prisoner, a young, uniformed soldier who glanced around the cell like a man viewing an apartment he's considering for rent. The soldier was tall and stood very straight. He towered over the guards, and though they had pistols in their holsters and the soldier was unarmed, he seemed ready to give orders. He held his Astrakhan fur hat in one hand and his leather gloves in the other. He looked at me just as the guards left, shutting the cell door and bolting it from the outside, taking their light with them. His face was the last thing I saw before the darkness resumed, so it stuck in my mind. The high Cossack cheekbones, the amused twist of the lips, the hay-blonde hair, the eyes blue enough to please any Aryan bride. I sat on the bed and he stood on the floor, and from the perfect silence, I knew neither of us had shifted position. We were still staring at each other in the darkness. "Are you a Jew?" he asked.
"What?"
"A Jew. You look like a Jew."
"You look like a Nazi."
"I know. Ich spreche ein bisschen Deutsch, too. I volunteered to be a spy, but nobody listened to me. So, you are a Jew?"
"Why do you care?"
"Don't be ashamed of it. I don't have a problem with Jews. Emmanuel Lasker is my second favorite chess player. Just a rung under Capablanca. Capablanca is Mozart, pure genius. You can't love chess and not love Capablanca. But Lasker, nobody's better in the endgame. You have any food?"
"No."
"Put out your hand." This seemed like some sort of trap, a game children played to snare morons. He would slap my palm, or just let it hang there till I realized my stupidity. But no offer of food could be refused, even the least likely, so I stretched my hand into the darkness and waited. A moment later, a sliver of something cold and greasy sat on my palm. I don't know how he found my hand, but he did, without any fumbling. "Sausage," he said, and then after a pause, "Don't worry, it's not pork."
"I eat pork."
I sniffed at the sausage and then nibbled off a bit. It was as far from real meat as rationed bread from real bread, but there was fat in it, and fat was life. I chewed on the sliver as slowly as I could, trying to make it last. "You chew loudly," he told me, a reprimand from the dark. I heard the creak of bedsprings as he sat on one of the lower bunk beds. "And you're supposed to say thank you."
"Thank you."
"You're welcome. What's your name?"
"Lev."
"Lev what?"
"What do you care?"
"It's just manners," he said. "For instance, if I introduce myself, I say, 'Good evening, my name is Nikolai Alexandrovich Vlasov. My friends call me Kolya.'"
"You just want to know if I have a Jewish name."
"Do you?"
"Yes."
"Ah," he sighed happily, pleased to hear his instincts confirmed. "Thank you. Don't know why you're so afraid of telling people." I didn't answer. If he didn't know why, there was no point explaining it.
"So, why are you here?" he asked.
"They caught me looting a dead German on Vonjova Street." This alarmed him.
"The Germans are already on Vonjova? So, it's begun."
"Nothing's begun. He was a bomber pilot. He ejected."
"The AA boys got him?"
"The cold got him."
"Why are you here?"
"Sheer idiocy. They think I'm a deserter."
"Why didn't they shoot you?"
"Don't know," I admitted. "They said I was a good one for the colonel." "I'm not a deserter. I'm a student. I was defending my thesis."
"Really? Your thesis?"
It sounded like the dumbest excuse in the history of desertion. "An interpretation of Yushakovo's The Courtyard Hound through the lens of contemporary sociological analysis." He waited for me to say something, but I had nothing to say to that. "You know the book?"
"No."
"Yushakovo? Miserable how bad the schools have gotten. They should have you memorizing passages." He sounded like a crotchety old professor, though from my one look at him, I would have guessed he was 20. "In the slaughterhouse where we first kissed, the air still stank from the blood of the lambs." First line. "Some say it's the greatest Russian novel. And you've never heard of it?" He sighed extravagantly. A moment later I heard a strange scratching sound, as if a rat were sharpening its claws on the mattress ticking.
What is that? I asked.
Hmm?
You don't hear that noise?
I'm writing in my journal.
I could see no farther with my eyes open than with them closed, and this one was writing in his journal. Now I could tell the scratching was a pencil on paper. After a few minutes, the journal slapped closed, and I heard him stuff the book into his pocket.
I can write in the dark, he said, punctuating the sentence with a light burp. One of my talents.
Notes on the courtyard hound?
Exactly. How's this for strange?
Chapter 6. Rachenko spends a month in the crosses because his former best friend...
Well, I don't want to give it away. But I have to say, it seemed like fate when they brought me here.
I'd been every other place Rachenko visited. Every restaurant and theater and graveyard. The ones that are still around anyway. But I've never been inside here. A critic could argue that until you spend a night in the crosses, you can't understand Rachenko.
Pretty lucky for you.
So you think they'll shoot us in the morning?
I doubt it.
They're not preserving us for the night just to shoot us tomorrow. He sounded quite jaunty about it, as if we were discussing a sporting event, as if the outcome wasn't particularly momentous no matter which way it went.
I haven't had a shit in 8 days, he confided. I'm not saying a good shit. It's been months since I've had a good shit. I mean no shit at all for 8 days.
We were quiet for a moment, considering these words.
How long do you think a man can last without shitting?
It was an interesting question, and I was curious to know the answer myself, but I didn't have one for him. I heard him lie down, heard him yawn happily, relaxed and content, his piss-stained straw mattress as comfortable as a feather bed. The silence lingered for a minute, and I thought my cellmate had fallen asleep.
These walls must be 4 feet thick, he said at last. This is probably the safest place in Peter to spend the night.
And then he did fall asleep, shifting from speech into snores so quickly that at first I thought he was faking. I've always envied people who sleep easily. Their brains must be cleaner, the floorboards of the skull well swept, all the little monsters closed up in the steamer trunk at the foot of the bed. I was born an insomniac, and that's the way I'll die, wasting thousands of hours along the way, longing for unconsciousness, longing for a rubber mallet to crack me in the head, not so hard, not hard enough to do any damage, just a good whack to put me down for the night. But that night, I didn't have a chance. I stared into the blackness until the blackness blurred into gray, until the ceiling above me began to take form, and the light from the east dribbled in through the narrow barred window that existed after all. Only then did I realize that I still had a German knife strapped to my calf. Chapter 3. An hour after dawn, two new guards opened the cell door, rousted us from bed, and clamped handcuffs on our wrists. They ignored my questions, but seemed amused when Kolya asked for a cup of tea and an omelet. Jokes must have been rare in the crosses, because it wasn't such a good joke, but the guards grinned as they shoved us down the hallway. Somewhere someone was moaning, a low and endless moan, a ship's horn heard from a great distance. I didn't know if we were heading for the gallows or an interrogation chamber. The night had passed without sleep. Save for a swig from the German's flask, there hadn't been a sip to drink since the rooftop of the Kirov. A lump the size of an infant's fist had swelled where my forehead had cracked the ceiling. It was a bad morning. Really, among my worst. But I wanted to live. I wanted to live, and I knew I could not face my execution without grace. I would kneel before the hangman or the firing squad and plead my youth, detail my many hours served on the rooftop waiting for the bombs, all the barricades I had helped to build, the ditches I had dug. All of us had done it. We were all serving the cause, but I was one of Peter's true sons, and I didn't deserve to die. What harm had been done? We drank a dead German's cognac. For this you want to end me? You want to tie a rough hemp around my skinny neck and shut down my brain forever because I stole a knife? Don't do this, comrade. I don't think there is greatness in me, but there is something better than this. The guards led us down a stone staircase, the steps beaten smooth by hundreds of thousands of boot heels. An old man with a heavy gray scarf wrapped twice around his throat sat on the far side of the iron bars that blocked the bottom of the staircase. He gave us a gummy grin and unlocked the gate. A moment later, we walked through the heavy wooden door into the sunlight, emerging from the crosses intact and alive. Kolya, unimpressed by our apparent reprieve, scooped up a palmful of clean snow with his shackled hands and licked it. The boldness of the maneuver made me jealous, as did the thought of cold water on my tongue. But I didn't want to do anything to anger the guards. Our escape from the crosses seemed like an odd mistake, and I expected to be shoved inside again if I did something wrong. The guards escorted us to a waiting GAZ, its big engine grumbling, exhaust pipes spewing dirty vapor, two soldiers sitting in the front seat watching us with zero curiosity, their fur-lined hats pulled down low on their foreheads. Kolya hopped into the back seat without waiting for an order.
Gentlemen, to the opera!
The guards, standards diminished by years of working the crosses, gave Kolya another good laugh. The soldiers did not. One of them turned and inspected Kolya.
You say another word, and I'll break your fucking arm. It were up to me. You'd already have a bullet in your head. Fucking deserter.
You,
and this was addressed to me,
get in.
Kolya's mouth was already open, and I knew violence was on the way. The soldier did not look like a bluffer, and Kolya clearly was incapable of heeding a simple threat.
I'm not a deserter, he said.
With his manacled hands, he managed to push up the left sleeve of his greatcoat, the left sleeve of his army sweater, the left sleeve of the two shirts beneath it, and offered his forearm to the soldier in the front seat.
You want to break the arm? Break it.
But I'm not a deserter. For a long count, nobody spoke. Kolya stared at the soldier stared back, and the rest of us watched and waited, impressed by this match of wills, and curious to see who would win. Finally, the soldier conceded defeat by turning away from Kolya and barking at me.
Get in the car, you little cunt!
The guards grinned. This was their morning's entertainment. They had no torture scheduled, no teeth to wrench, no nails to pluck from a screaming man's nail beds, so they got their fun watching me, the little cunt, scurry into the back seat next to Kolya. The soldiers drove very fast, caring not at all about the slicks of ice on the road. We sped along the banks of the frozen Neva. I had my collar upturned so I could hide my face from the wind that blasted in beneath the canvas roof. Kolya didn't seem bothered by the cold. He stared at the spire of the Church of John the Baptist across the river and said nothing. We turned onto the Kamyon-Ostrovsky Bridge. The old steel of its arches rimed with frost, the lampposts bearded with icicles. Onto Kamenyi Island, slowing only a bit to circle around a bomb crater that had shattered the center of the road, pulling into a long driveway lined with the stumps of lime trees, and parking in front of a magnificent wooden mansion with a white-columned portico. Kolya studied the house. The Dolgurukovs lived here, he said as we stepped out of the car. I suppose none of you have heard of the Dolgurukovs. A bunch of aristocrats who got their necks snapped, said one of the soldiers, gesturing with a barrel of his rifle for us to walk toward the front door.
Some of them, admitted Kolya, and some of them slept with emperors.
In the daylight, Kolya looked like he could have stepped out of one of the propaganda posters pasted on walls throughout the city. The angles of his face were heroic, the strong chin, the straight nose, the blonde hair that fell across his forehead. He was a fine-looking deserter. The soldiers escorted us onto the porch, where sandbags had been piled 4 feet high to form a machine gun nest. Two soldiers sat near their gun, passing a cigarette between them. Kolya sniffed the air and stared longingly at the hand-rolled butt. Real tobacco, he said, before our armed guides pushed open the front door and herded us inside. I had never been inside a mansion before, had only read about them in the novels. The dances on the parquet floors, the servants ladling soup from silver tureens, the stern patriarch in his book-lined study, warning his weeping daughter to stay away from the low-born boy. But while the old Dolgurukov home still looked magnificent on the outside, the revolution had come to the interior. The marble floor was tracked with 1,000 muddy boot prints, unwashed for months. The smoke-stained wallpaper curled away from the baseboards. None of the original furniture had survived, none of the oil paintings and Chinese vases that must have lined the walls and rested on teak shelves. Dozens of uniformed officers hurried from one room to the next, hustled up a curving double staircase missing its balustrade, and all the balusters, probably torn down for firewood, weeks ago. The uniforms were not Red Army. Kolya noticed me staring.
NKVD. Maybe they think we're spies.
I didn't need Kolya to tell me the men were NKVD. Since I was little, I had known what their uniforms looked like, with their peaked blue and maroon caps and their holstered Tokarevs. I had learned to dread the sight of their Packards idling outside the gates of the Kirov, the Black Ravens, waiting to carry some unlucky citizen away from his home. The NKVD arrested at least 15 men from the building while I lived there. Sometimes those taken returned after a few weeks, their heads shaved and their faces pale and lifeless, avoiding my eyes in the stairwell as they limped up to their apartments. The broken men who came home must have known how rare and lucky they were, but they took no apparent joy in their survival. They knew what happened to my father, and they could not meet my eyes. The soldiers kept prodding us forward till we entered a sunroom at the very rear of the house, the tall French windows offering a fine vantage of the Neva and the grim, stolid apartment buildings of the Vyborg section on the far side of the river. An older man sat alone at a simple wood desk, set down in the middle of the sunroom. He had a telephone receiver nestled between his face and his shoulder so he could scribble with a pen on a pad of paper as he listened. He glanced at us as we waited at the entryway. He looked like an ex-boxer with his thick neck and crooked flattened nose. The shadows below his hooded eyes were deep, as were the furrows that crossed his forehead. His gray hair was shaved very close to the scalp. He might have been 50 years old, but he looked like he could rise from his chair and beat us all down without mussing his uniform. Three metal stars shone on the collar tabs of his jacket. I didn't know precisely what three stars signified, but they were three stars more than anyone else in the mansion. He tossed his pad of paper on the desk, and I could see that he hadn't been taking notes as I'd thought, but simply drawing X's over and over again, till the entire sheet of paper was covered with them. For some reason, this frightened me more than his uniform or his brawler's face. A man who drew pictures of tits or dogs seemed like a man I could understand, but a man who drew nothing but X's? He was watching us, Kolya and me, and I knew that he was judging us, condemning us for our crimes, and sentencing us to death, all while listening to a voice traveling across wires. Good, he said at last. I want it done by noon. No exceptions. He hung up the phone and smiled at us, and the smile was as incongruous on his face as the man and his plain wood desk were in the gorgeous sunroom of the old noble house. The colonel, for I assume now that this was the colonel the soldiers had spoken of the night before, had a beautiful smile, his teeth surprisingly white, his brutal face shifting instantly from menace to welcome. The deserter and the looter. Come. Come closer. We don't need the cuffs. I don't think these boys will cause any trouble. He gestured to the soldiers, who reluctantly pulled out their keys and removed our manacles. I'm not a deserter, said Kolya. No? Go, he ordered the soldiers, not bothering to look at them. The soldiers obeyed, leaving us alone with the colonel. He stood and walked toward us, the pistol on his waist holster slapping against his hip. Kolya stood very straight, at attention, for the officer's inspection, and I, not knowing what to do, followed his lead. The colonel kept coming until his battered face nearly touched Kolya's.
You're not a deserter, and yet your unit reported you missing, and you were picked up 40 kilometers from where you were supposed to be?